Welcome to episode 17 of Checking the Gate, a film and religion podcast.
I am Michael M. Patty, Esquire.
And I am Robert Wright Stasko, and we are here today to talk to you about Planet of the Apes and
the Stephen King miniseries from 1994, The Stand.
Do you remember the first time you saw Planet of the Apes?
I don't, because it came out 9 years before I was born, so it was always there, and I'm sure it was on TV one day, and my dad probably had it on, and I remember thinking it was cool that the monkeys were talking, and their lips weren't quite in sync with the dialogue, but it was okay. You know, I knew they were people in masks, but it was all right because it was still talking monkeys and it was still cool. And it had a twist ending. And, you know, what's not to like when you're a kid about Planet of the Apes?
Yeah, you probably saw the same thing I did. I was a little older, though. It was on Channel 43 when they were still sort of locally owned. And they had Planet of the Apes Week, where they showed all five movies. And then I think like 6 months later they had Planet of the Apes Week 2, where they showed like the series that came out. They showed two episodes like every night.
I have not seen any episodes of Planet of the Apes, the series. It's on my Netflix list, and I'm not sure we could have included it as TV Corner from what I've heard.
Yeah, I've got it from the library, the Akron Public Library, but I have not watched it yet, and I had to return it.
Oh. What do you mean yet? You mean you have to recheck it out, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So when I first watched it, like I said, I was probably a little older than you were. And like the first time I saw it,
you're probably the same amount older than me then than you are now, you are now.
That ratio has not changed that amount of time. But anyways, when I first saw it, I was sort of struck by, you know, the injustice Taylor has to endure at the stinking paws of the apes. And I remember feeling just, wow, how unfair he's being treated, and why don't they listen to him? And he's telling them the truth, and you don't believe it. And then the next thing I remember is just that final scene, that you know, the twist ending, that painful shock that he's been on Earth the whole time. Spoilers! So, but you know, that stayed with me like for days after I saw it.
I think after 44 years, the spoiler alert for Planet of the Apes has been taken off.
Oh, and in case you haven't seen Star Wars.
Yeah, when we finally get to Star Wars, we're going to spoil the heck out of that movie.
Darth Vader is Luke's father. Sorry. I remember probably, I think, a bit more vividly my disappointment at the 2001 remake.
The less said about that, the better.
Yeah. Well, it does look at Christianity a different way. We'll probably talk about it a little later. I know you said the less said, the better.
The less said, the better. I'm going to stick to that.
So we'll say a little bit about it.
Okay. I'm going to tear into that movie the way I did Passion of the Christ. There's so much fundamentally wrong with the actual film that it doesn't warrant any kind. The length of this sentence, it is more than it deserves.
All right, then stop talking about it. Let's move on to the original. This one has, I think, a lot more to say about race relations and stuff, and that's probably the more surface allegory to this movie.
Absolutely. This is the only film in the Planet of the Apes franchise that really tries to make any kind of beneath-the-surface allegorical statement. The rest are just shameless cash-in sequels, each to varying degrees. But the first one actually made an attempt to make a social consciousness point. The screenplay was adapted from a novel by the French writer Pierre Boulez, which I've read, and it's okay. In the book, an astronaut ends up on another planet. It's not Earth, but in the story, the framework is that an astronaut is, I think he's reading a story or he's, you know, being told a story. Anyway, he's hearing about the tale of the astronaut, whose name may or may not be Taylor, I don't remember, on the Planet of the Apes. He's a human, and he ends up with the apes, and a lot of the stuff in the movie is similar, and some of it's different, but the twist at the end of the book is the astronaut turns out to be an ape, and he finds the story of the human completely unrealistic.
Okay.
The novel was adapted for the screen by Twilight Zone maestro Rod Serling, and so you can clearly see... if you've seen your share of Twilight Zone episodes, you can clearly see his influence all over the irony and the twists.
He did, like, the first pass at a script, and then I forget who did the second pass, but Serling is definitely responsible for the Cold War undercurrent that goes through the threat of nuclear annihilation. And, like, especially the stuff Taylor says at the beginning where he's so glad to be running away from Earth. He's like, I'm sick of people, I hate them, is basically what he says. And I can't wait to see when we get back to Earth in the future how men are going to be better.
Yeah.
You know, it's that...
Surprise!
Yeah. I guess their mission, they're supposed to go to another planet, explore it, and then come back to Earth. So it's on the very hard science concept of relativity, where they're traveling at very fast speeds, so... Time
would pass different on Earth.
Yeah.
It would pass more slowly to those on Earth than it would for them.
Right. They make a point to say, we're on another planet in the future. We're never going to get back home again. And I like the point where one of their party dies. One of the other astronauts is bearing this... it's the woman who dies.
Yeah.
And he sticks an American flag in there, and Taylor just laughs. You know, and this sort of flies in the face of the kind of character Charlton Heston has portrayed in the past.
There's no America anymore. But it turns out they're there anyway.
So, you know, they meet the apes. They're taken prisoner by them, and Taylor gets shot in the throat, and he is taken under the care of Cornelius and Zira to animal psychologists who study the humans and dissect them, and... Actually, Cornelius is an archaeologist, and Zira is the psychologist. They're chimpanzees, and they're ruled by the
Science Council?
Yes, the orangutan sort of overclass.
Yeah.
And they're the scientific and religious leaders, which is very interesting that they're in charge of both things. And the gorillas, we find, are more like the soldiers. And there's conflict between the chimpanzees and the orangutans as... It seems like the orangutans are keeping the chimps down. They're university professors, and the chimps are like the undergrad students.
Yeah, it's in addition to the race parallel. There's also a lot of caste and social hierarchy. And I'm not sure, not being a sociologist myself, and not having been around in the 60s, I'm not entirely sure what parallels there were as far as that goes with what's in the movie and what's in real life. It seems like in the movie there's the very strict by species.
Yeah.
This is what you can do, and the chimps are never going to be on the Science Council with the orangutans.
Right, it seems like they were given...
The orangutans are never going to be soldiers, but everybody hates humans.
Yeah.
Except for Cornelius and Zira.
Yeah, and it seems like they had to get, like, special permission to be scientists from the orangutans. And they had to be very careful what they did or said in fear of having their credentials taken away or something. So we enter Dr. Zaius, you know, the head orangutan, and he seems to be the guardian of knowledge in the one who is definitely what you might call the villain of the story. And,
yes.
You know, how do you feel about Dr. Zaius?
I like Dr. Zaius in the movie. He is a very likable, quote-unquote, villain. He does know more than he's letting on, and you know he knows more than he's letting on. He's got a lot of charisma in the movie, even though he's a jerk.
Yeah, and I didn't really pick up on this until, like, the last time I watched it with my wife, and she pointed out he knew all along what... the exact truth was.
Oh yeah.
And my take on it is that, like all villains, he thinks he's the good guy. He knows the truth, everything he does, he wants to neuter Taylor. He wants to kill him. He wants to put him on trial and, you know, do everything he can. And also to destroy Zira and Cornelius's work, all to protect ape society, because he knows what man has done in the past. And I think on some level he understands that Taylor and the other astronauts came from the past. And he knows his scripture that says, beware the animal man, for he is, what does it say? He's the devil's servant or something. He's
They have holy scrolls.
Yeah.
In Planet of the Apes. That's how it ties into religion in film. It's not just they're trying to keep them from knowing they're on Earth. There is a sacred law that has been passed down that humans are inferior.
Yeah. Yeah, their lawgiver said, do not let them breed in great numbers, for they will make a desert of your land and theirs. And these scrolls are mentioned during the time that they're put Taylor on trial, and they talk about how apes were made in the image of God and not humans. How could they talk? Which has repercussions later on in the series, like in Escape from the Planet of the Apes, when Cornelius and Zira accidentally go back in time and they're put on trial, and they mention that they're married, and one of the priests kind of stands up and says, what? And that's the only sort of like religious comment that they make in that movie. But
is there some kind of parallel in that to to either that time or now?
I think it probably speaks more now.
I think you're right. Well, yeah. Back then it would have been racial in the 70s.
Yeah. Now we don't discriminate so much more by race and skin color as we do. I'm not saying that it doesn't go on. I'm saying it's not as prevalent as our discrimination of sexual orientation. Just goes to show how these movies really have a lasting impact. And it could be an allegory for much more than just race relations.
Cash in sequel or not.
But getting back to Dr. Zaius, I think he's protecting those and not so much deliberately conspiring to like keep himself in power. I don't know, what do you think about that?
I got the impression that he was trying to keep the truth from them. Whether or not he knew they were from the past, he knew they were talking humans, and he knew there were talking humans in their past, and all he was concerned with was preventing them from finding the forbidden land and keeping himself, you know, keeping the apes dominant.
Ah, so you think there was more of a conspiracy?
At the very least, he knew what was going on, like what you said, and he was clearly trying to prevent them from finding that out.
There was an alternate ending, where they mentioned something that Nova is pregnant, which would then lead to more talking humans, which I think would have thrown Dr. Zaius into a tizzy. They kind of mentioned that a little bit in Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Like at the beginning, Taylor mentions, we should settle down and have kids, and maybe I could teach them to talk. And then he disappears, and then they blow up the planet.
Yeah.
So that ain't going to happen, but
poor Nova.
If you want to read a little more about the racial allegory in this, you could pick up Eric Green's book called Planet of the Apes as American Myth, Race, Politics, and Popular Culture. And he actually did an informational text commentary on the last Planet of the Apes DVD release that came out, like the special edition.
It may or may not be on the Blu-ray.
I haven't seen the Blu-rays.
I actually own the DVD that Robert's talking about, but the last time I saw Planet of the Apes, it was on Matt Big Hungry Lentner's Blu-ray set that he let me borrow. He let me borrow the box set, and I watched all five of them over Memorial Day weekend last year.
Eric Green, he does mention a little bit about the religious aspect in the movie, and here's how he delves a little deeper into that allegory. He says, Heston's previous race war films and other films that malign non-white and non-Christian peoples participate in the construction of the necessary ideological support of racism and imperialism by constructing whiteness and Christianity as civility, order, rationality, and imperial privilege, while defining the non-white and the non-Christian as hostile, chaotic, untrustworthy, irrational, and deserving of domination. So an example of this would be the Ten Commandments, which in Flesher and Torrey's book, Film and Religion, an Introduction, they talk about how that is more about the Cold War dynamic that was going on. Like, Egypt is like the tyrannical Russian Empire, and Israel is like the freedom-fighting Americans. The law is freedom and stuff, and Moses releases them and sets them free. And
you know, I can honestly say I've never thought about the Ten Commandments being a political allegory.
It is, because
I haven't seen it since I was a kid. So
yeah. Well, when they play it on TV, they cut out the introduction where Cecil B. DeMille comes out from behind the curtain and says, this movie is about the Cold War. He basically says, this is what it's about. And then goes back, and then the movie starts. But they cut that out for time and stuff. And when they put
they
it on TV,
cut something out of a 5-hour movie for time.
Imagine that. But Eric Green goes on to say, without this ideological underpinning, undertakings like the Vietnam War would have been far more difficult to initiate and sustain. His point is, we see a reversal of that in this movie. Charlton Heston is playing against type, or usually he is the leader. I mean, and it's more than just the Ten Commandments. There are other ones where he's like the hero fighting against some African tribe, or in World War II. Or there's a point where he's running around the Ape City trying to escape, and he gets caught up in the net, and he says the line, "Get your sticking paws off me." At some point, his stunt double was, you know, doing some of the stunts in that. And he turned to Charlton Heston and said, I remember when we used to win these things. So, yeah, they took that type and turned it on its head. Or instead of being sort of the symbol of white supremacy, he is the one who is being unfairly treated.
Yeah, if the movie had been made in the 80s, it still may have had Charlton Heston. I think he was still making action movies into the early 80s. If it had been made, well, let's say 10 years later, if it had been made in 78, the astronauts would have landed on the planet, and Charlton Heston would have kicked butts, taken names, found out they were still on Earth, and taken the planet back, and everyone would be cheering.
Yeah. This one, it definitely has a downer of an ending. And
yeah.
It's surprising that, you know, all five of the original movies were financially successful, and all of them have a downer of an ending.
Especially the third one.
Yeah.
Especially the third one.
Because the third one ends with Cornelius and Zira being shot.
Yeah.
And their baby.
No, not the baby. The baby survives.
It's what you think is the baby. They did a switch with a
Well, no, the
baby
audience
ship.
The audience knows.
Yeah, but the other guys don't.
Okay.
There's some dramatic irony where the killers don't. And Caesar survives in the next movie, which this one is Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, the fourth one, where it's definitely just, it's not even under the surface. It's on top for all to see. This is a movie about race relations and how bad they are right now, where the apes rise up and overthrow their human slave masters. The last movie is interesting because we have...
It's set entirely in the future after apes are dominant.
Right, and they're trying to live peacefully with the humans.
It's not going very well.
Yeah, and they kind of come to a peace at the end. And the last shot, you see like a tear coming down the statue of Caesar. And in Eric Green's book, he talks about you could take it both ways. Like, either he's happy that, like, Dr. King's dream...
I felt it was hopeful. I thought, you know, maybe they have learned from history and things will be different when Taylor gets there again.
But you see, I took it the other way. Like, he's crying like he knows they're all going to die anyways. And that's how I took it. I took the other way. Like, it is, like, sad and tragic. And no matter how much we try for peace, it's just not going to happen. So I respectfully disagree with you, sir.
Okay.
I think the last thing we'll mention about, like, the original series is the second movie, Beneath the Planet of the Apes, where we find that there is a race of humans who have been surviving in the Forbidden Zone.
And they worship a bomb.
They worship the nuclear bomb.
As we all should, because that's really what keeps us safe.
Mutually assured destruction.
Yes.
That's what keeps us safe. Here, let's look at what Eric Green says.
If I get destroyed, at least my destroyer will get destroyed. Ergo, I am safe.
That's right. But here's what Eric Green says about the second movie. The mutants' bomb worship is a fascinating inversion of Christian belief and ritual. Recalling Jesus' statement that he was the Alpha and the Omega, the bomb has those very Greek letters on one of its fins. Moreover, its role in the mutants' religious mythology is similar to that of Jesus in Christianity. The mutants hold that the bomb should be venerated because it's one of its ancestors, an earlier bomb, had made the mutants what they were. As a later model bomb, the Alpha and Omega bomb was metaphorically the descendant of their maker. Thus, the Alpha and Omega bomb was the child of their god, and its presence and power could usher in the final apocalypse. The mutant hymns and liturgy with the references to the blessing of the bomb almighty and the fellowship of the holy fallout are adapted from text used in Christian observance. The bomb even looks like an upside-down cross, and Taylor sardonically explains that the bomb built in the sweet name of peace can burn the planet to a cinder. How's that for your ultimate weapon? The weapon of the Doomsday Bomb as a holy weapon of peace is perhaps the ultimate extension of the nuclear deterrence theory that envisioned mutually assured destruction as the greatest protector of life.
Once again, we come back to the recurring theme that even in post-apocalyptic societies, there's still plenty of weapons to go around.
You know, where do they come from?
At least in The Stand, when it happens, it's like 3 months after the end of society and not several millennia.
Yeah, the nuclear reactors haven't melted down yet, much to Trash Can Man's delight.
Yeah.
So before we get into The Stand,
yes,
we could talk a little bit more about the Christian allegory in the remake.
Okay.
You remember the guerrilla general played by Michael Clark Duncan?
Attar.
He's the religious ape. You know, he's the one, yes, who slams on the table, "Bow your heads!" before they eat. And he prays to Seamus, I guess their ape god, and they look forward, yeah, to his coming again.
The myth in the movie is that Seamus,
yes,
came down from the heavens and all apes are descended from him.
Yeah, and he's going to come again.
And he's going to come again, much like Adam and Eve and Jesus and, you know, all that. And it turns out that's not entirely untrue. As I'm fond of saying, I felt that this was a sledgehammer.
Yeah.
That the only reason religion is in this movie is to drive the plot along and to make it a dramatic point when Attar has to choose between Tim Roth's General Fade and Mark Wahlberg's Leo Davidson.
Yeah.
The only reason he's religious is when he finds out that Seamus was actually one of the chimps from the Captain Davidson's spaceship.
Yeah.
What happens is a chimp goes from the spaceship, goes to investigate a storm, and gets lost. Marky Mark goes off to find him. The ship goes off to find him.
The ship crashes first.
The ship crashes first, Marky Mark crashes second, and then the chimp comes in at the end of the movie, and Michael Clark Duncan thinks it's Seamus.
Right.
Which was laughable, by the way. It was hilarious.
Yeah. And they all bow down.
Yeah. Because the audience knows what's going on.
Yeah.
And then, Seamus?
It's kind of like the ending of Red State.
Kind of, yeah. And so the only reason the apes have this, and it turns out that, you know, once again, like in the original, Charlton Heston plays Thade's dad. He knows what's going on somehow. It's not really clear. He knows that the humans were on the ship with the chimps, and that's why there are humans and apes,
and their religion.
That's why everybody speaks English, and nowhere in any of these movies, Charlton Heston and Mark Wahlberg never stop to think, how can everybody still speak English?
Yeah.
And narratively, there is, once they explain what's going on, you know, they're in post-apocalyptic America, or they're all descended from a spaceship from 2029 where everybody spoke English. It doesn't explain why the chimps got the ability to speak, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, but in the remake, it's definitely more clear than in the original that the religion was a tool to keep people in control.
Right.
It was to keep them from thinking too much about their past so they wouldn't know the truth.
Yeah, that humans were their masters.
Right. They didn't want them to know that at all.
But seriously, from a screenwriting and filmmaking perspective, did it have to be a religion?
I don't think so.
Right. That's my point. It could have been anything.
It could have been just like a secret, like, oh, we discovered this. So what do you think... In these two films, the filmmakers are trying to say by using religion in such a way?
I think in the first one, it's clearly supposed to be a society similar to our own, except maybe for the rigid castes. Mm-hmm. In America, even back then, was super religious. They love the Lord in this country. And I think that was definitely included to be part of their life. And it goes hand in hand, like you were saying, with science to them. It's very important to them. And Dr. Zaius uses that to his advantage. Not that he doesn't... I want to say maybe his faith has been shaken because he knows the truth about humans on the planet. That's not to say he's not religious, but...
Yeah, I would say that, they talk about the lawgiver and they follow... I think their religion is more closely tied to Judaism than it is to Christianity.
Okay.
And in the remake, it's definitely more like Christianity.
There's just, in the second one, it's shoehorned in. It's just, it's bad screenwriting in an otherwise completely unnotable, unnecessary film. If you're going to make a new Planet of the Apes movie, just do a remake. Just have Cornelius and Dr. Zaius and a new Charlton Heston. Don't reimagine it, because... What really struck me when I was watching it was the only good thing is the makeup.
Yeah.
The script, the dialogue was god-awful. It looks like it was directed by Brett Ratner or McGee instead of Tim Burton. I'm not kidding. I honestly thought that.
I have to agree with you there.
It was so poorly staged.
Yeah. Everything looked like a set, didn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
Everything looked like a set. Even the live locations.
When they showed the apes jumping, they always cut to it mid-air. You could tell it didn't actually jump off the ground, that it was a stunt guy catapulted off something. It was technically bad. The screenwriting wasn't very good.
The acting was all right.
No, it wasn't.
I like Tim Roth and Paul Giamatti.
The actors were all right. The acting was not.
Yeah.
Why did their voices still sound like they were muffled? Why didn't they redub them?
That's a good point, because maybe...
Stuff like that is what bothered me about this movie.
Yeah, Michael Clark Duncan always sounded like he had something in his mouth, which he did. He had all those teeth.
Redub him. The apes don't have prosthetics on.
Here's what I think. I think these movies see religion as a bad force in society that conspires to hide the truth from the masses in furthers fanatical belief, and that's what leads to destruction. The Christianity that I believe in promotes freedom from those kind of ideals. Yeah, we talked about this earlier in other post-apocalyptic movies. We are sinful creatures are going to fight, and as Cornelius says, kill our brother for our land without the aid of religion to hold our aggression at bay. We can't blame religion for this thing that we're going to do anyway. People want to blame religion for all the violence. I know that I am a sinful person, not fit to stand in the presence of God, but I know that Jesus' sinless life, his death on the cross, pays for my sins so I can be with him. And in the meantime, he sends his Holy Spirit that fills me with love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. These are all the fruits of the Spirit. And these are the things that guide me away and could guide everyone away from the maniacal behavior that leads to mutual assured destruction and nuclear annihilation. We need peace and patience with each other, kindness, goodness, all these things. So I think that since we're created in God's image, let's turn to him and his peaceful ways and not give the apes a chance to argue with us about it.
I, for one, welcome our future ape overlords. it's not really touched on in the movies, but there might be something to be said about evolution.
A planet where apes evolved from men?
It's not really about the fact that humans are descended from apes. It's that something had to take... The point of the first movie is humans destroyed themselves. It's not really about how what the proper course evolution should, quote-unquote, be. So I'm not sure that discussion is relevant.
Well, in that text commentary, they talk about how when Taylor is on trial, it's kind of like the Scopes monkey trial, is what they called it, where they had creation versus evolution down in Tennessee. There are definitely parallels there. And you kind of get the feeling that the screenwriters essentially felt that evolution was the truth, and Dr. Zayas knows this as a scientist, but as a religious leader, he obeys, you know, his scriptures and what the lawgiver says, and sort of perpetuates that when he knows one is true and the other is not.
Yeah. At the very least, it's survival of the fittest, and the apes prove themselves to be fittest after the destruction.
After humans are stupid enough to kill themselves off?
Right.
You blew it up!
You maniacs!
Finally did it!
This is probably one of the most quotable movies of all time.
Yeah, it's several.
I'm really proud of our restraint that we haven't just every 5 minutes. We've kept it at every 10 minutes or so.
It's a madhouse! A madhouse!
I think that's all we have to say about that.
We're not going to discuss Rise of the Planet of the Apes, because as cool as that was, that really is a cash-in franchise movie. James Franco plays a scientist. That's all.
Anything to say about that.
wonderful performance by Andy Serkis. Can't wait for the sequel, Planet of the Planet of the Apes. I just thought of that. Oh, God, I just killed Robert.
Yeah, he gave me an aneurysm there. Oh, that was funny. All right. Now's the perfect time to talk about The Stand. The Stand was, I think this was like the last of a series of really, really good Stephen King miniseries adaptations on TV.
It's probably been the last good one.
Yeah.
They've made more.
Yeah, I remember Rose Red was sort of like...
I remember somebody I worked with, I didn't want to watch it. The commercials didn't look very good, and it wasn't based on a book, so I didn't bother. Somebody at work came in and said she liked part one. After part two, out of, I think, three, she's like, yeah, no. So I skipped that one. They made a Shining remake, which was okay.
Yeah.
Storm of the Century was halfway decent. I don't know if you ever saw that. That was original. If you want to see it, I've got it upstairs.
Okay.
It's pretty good. Do you know who Colin Feore is?
Yeah.
He's super creepy in it. First thing I ever saw him in.
Oh, yeah, I like him. Oh, yeah, you sold me. I'll watch it. but I remember watching it on TV.
It was really good.
And I remember watching Tommyknockers, which wasn't so good.
Yeah.
But The Stand, I think, is probably the best Stephen King miniseries
that's been on TV. It's okay. And let me...
I think it's the best.
I think it is the best.
In quotation marks.
Stephen King's It.
Okay.
Is the best of the Stephen King miniseries. The reason I'm going to temper that is I was really excited about it when it first came on. The Stand was the first thing I ever saw Gary Sinise in.
Yeah.
I read the book in high school, and I remember liking it. And then the miniseries came out, and it was good. Fantastic cast.
Oh,
if you've ever read the book, everyone is cast perfectly. I can't say all the acting is perfect.
Yeah.
But everybody looks and speaks the part as they are in the book.
Yeah.
And you know how sometimes when you like things when you're younger, and then you revisit them when you're a little older... And sometimes the polish has come off of it.
Yeah.
Well, I've gotten into audiobooks.
Yeah.
In the last couple years, since 2005, I've worked like 40 or 45 minutes from where I live. So I have a long time in the car every day, and audiobooks are my friend. Well, lately, I have been re-listening to some Stephen King audiobooks that I read back in the day. It is a masterpiece. I highly recommend it. Get the one that Stephen Weber reads. Check your local library's downloadable site. Highly recommended.
Overdrive.
Yes.
Is the program.
Yes. A local company.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They are based in Valley View.
Cool.
The Stand is a different story. Now that I've read a lot more Stephen King, I can really tell that it was like the fourth book he ever wrote back in the 70s.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he updated it for 1990. He changed a lot of the dates. He added a lot of stuff in that he cut. He even in the introduction says that he still left some stuff out on the floor that didn't get put back in to the complete and uncut version. And having already listened to it, it felt like a step backwards in the description that makes him such a good writer wasn't quite there.
Yeah.
It was still okay. It wasn't awful. But he hadn't gotten to be the master yet.
Yeah.
And I could tell. And the miniseries is good. It's not great. It's got some really cheesy stage scenes and some cheesy dialogue. And as far as adaptations go, King wrote the script, so it follows the story of the book really closely. There are a few shortcuts here and there, but nothing that hurts the narrative. All the high points are still there. All the main set pieces are still in. But the direction, I think, is a little weak. So it's all right, but by this point in this extended narrative of why we're discussing a classic Stephen King book and an ancient in TV terms miniseries, in the introduction in the audiobook, King writes that it's a tale of dark Christianity. And as soon as I heard that, I'm like, oh, podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm ashamed to say it's a little sledgehammery again, but yeah. It is. The parallels are really, really obvious. Mother Abigail is the put upon Messiah who has to lead them out of Nebraska and the East and into Boulder, yeah. Colorado.
She's a gospel Moses.
Yes. Randall Flagg, who it's implied is the Man in Black from the Dark Tower series, although this is his first appearance, so you can either discount that or take it however you will. He is a demon. You know, everybody's a pilgrim, and you've got your people who are, you know, religious, and you've got people who aren't, and
yeah, basically, there's a plague that hits. It's like a super flu, sort of wipes everybody out except for a few survivors who gather together, some in Colorado under Mother Abigail, who they hear the spirit, hear God. They have visions of her calling out to them.
Yeah, then Flag and Mother Abigail both come to the survivors in their dreams, and the survivors end up choosing sides. And
yeah.
And of course there's a big showdown.
Yeah.
But not really. It kind of, like the world ending, it comes with a whimper,
yeah.
I thought.
Yeah. I like the ending in the miniseries.
It's the same in the book. The hand of God comes down during a show trial. And
one of the guys, Trash Can Man, played by Matt Frewer.
Yes.
The magnificent Matt Frewer.
Oh, yeah.
He brings a nuclear bomb to this trial, and God picks it up, sets it off, and blows up all the bad people.
Yeah.
So
two of our heroes who sacrifice themselves.
Yeah. I really like The Stand because Stephen King really has a good grip on what drives people, both good people and bad people. And he depicts them realistically. I mean, you really get into Stu, played by
Gary
Sinise. You really get into his character. And that's what really commits you to this. You really get involved in the characters. And the kind of only gripe I have is that at the end when, you know, God blows up Las Vegas. And correct me if I'm wrong, but don't they kind of have to figure out what happened after Las Vegas blows up and, you know, bad things stop happening? They piece together and figure out what happened.
I was under the impression, and it's not really clear in the book, but they all knew what happened through the visions and that they were getting
But it's nothing. It was nothing like definite. Like, oh, God blew up Las Vegas, so we don't have to worry about it anymore.
I don't know.
It wasn't that clear.
At the very least, when Stu got back to Boulder, he could see the blast from where he was. And this is kind of a cop-out on King's part. He didn't know how to keep the main character alive, so he had him break his leg and didn't make it to Vegas, so he didn't get blown up.
Yeah.
But him and another character who escaped get back to Boulder, and at that point, Stu tells them that he doesn't. Maybe not the hand of God part, but
yeah, and see, that's the part where I have trouble with is like all through the Bible, when God does something awesome like that, there's always someone to see it and tell about it. Because one thing that God wants is to be glorified, and if no one's around to see it, how can he be glorified?
So Mother Abigail did a lot of glorifying of God. So I think by that point in the story, everybody kind of knew that events had been set in motion by higher powers, and when Vegas went up, I think that was a clear enough sign who won.
Yeah. But I think it should have been more definite, like a proclamation with,
party! And that comes back to, it was written early in his career. If he rebooted The Stand, if we got Stand 3.0, and I'm counting 1978 and complete and uncut, if he started from scratch, I think it would be a lot better, and it might be clearer, I think. And if he took what he's done with The Dark Tower and put that on top of Randall Flagg's character more deliberately, rather than the other way around, I think it might be better.
Yeah, plus I don't think Stephen King would be that much of a religious scholar to... I think we should have more glorification. That's not a hallmark of Stephen King's writing. But it did kind of lead me to think, the last time I watched it, like, what Trash Can Man, like, who he was really serving. Because all during, he'd see, like, all for you, and you think it's
That's
about
the thing. No, Trash
Flag.
Can Man was definitely serving Flag the entire time. And that's why he was the perfect tool, I thought.
Yeah.
Because he would deliver a bomb to him and think it was a good idea.
Yeah. But in the end...
In the end, it's not a good idea. Yeah. It's never a good idea to just go driving nuclear weapons around in an ATV. I learned that the hard way. wear a helmet, kids.
My face melted off. Why? Okay, so final thoughts on The Stand.
I'm not going to make any final thoughts on its religious relevance, but after taking 6 weeks to listen to 48 hours of audiobook and then 6 hours of miniseries, it feels a little weird to finally have it behind me. It was quite a slog, and especially doing it twice. Yeah. But onward and upward.
Every time I watch it, I like it. And I have not read the book, and just incidentally, you have gotten me on the audiobook thing. So I've downloaded the
47 hours, 47 minutes.
Yes, from audible.com, and I can listen to it on my new tablet now. You know, you mentioned me, you've been listening to audiobooks. So I started listening to some. I got The Hunger Games by Suzanne Collins. And yeah, it's a young adult book, but my criticism of it was she would describe conversations instead of putting in the dialogue. And I had sort of the reverse criticism for Stephen King, is he would have these really long conversations that seem to go nowhere, and I was like, okay, just, let's get moving here.
Yeah, so. You're absolutely right. I love the man's writing, but you're absolutely right. That is one of his common themes, is he'll do entire conversations line for line and not do any shortcutting. Final thoughts on Planet of the Apes?
Oh, watch the original.
Yes.
Not the remake.
Skip the 2001 version and watch the other six.
Yes, Rise of the Planet of the Apes and Planet of the Planet of the Apes. I think for real it's going to be called Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, okay. And Andy Serkis is back, and that's all I've
fantastic.
Heard about
fantastic.
So for next time, I'm looking at the schedule here, and October is Halloween.
What does Halloween have to do with religion?
Halloween. It's All Hallows Eve.
Oh, not the movie Halloween.
No, not the movie Halloween.
Okay.
We do have some horror movies, some scary movies.
I'm as interested in as the audience to find out.
One is actually scary, and one is just frighteningly bad.
Oh, boy.
So we have The Exorcist that we could talk about, the first part.
I didn't like The Exorcist.
Also, Constantine.
Constantine was okay.
I like Constantine. I think it's got a bad rap.
For a movie with Keanu Reeves and Shia LaBeouf, it wasn't as nearly as bad as I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. So we'll talk about those for next time.
Which one is bad? I'm confused which one you meant.
We'll
leave it to the audience to decide.
Yeah, I'm going by critical reviews.
Okay.
The Exorcist is held up as this great paragon of
the horror genre.
And Constantine is poo-pooed by critics and comic book fans alike.
Yeah.
Basically because the comic book character has blonde hair.
And is British.
Yeah, and Keanu Reeves is neither. And I'm like, when has any adaptation ever followed the book exactly?
The Stand.
The 47-hour miniseries.
as closely as you could in a four-part miniseries, the Stand is as faithful an adaptation as you're going to find.
Well, then why am I listening to the audiobook, Mike? Why am I listening to 47 hours?
I don't know. I told you to listen to it.
Okay, I'll listen to it instead.
All right.
So until next time, you could find us on the internet at www.ctgpodcast.com. Send us an email at ctgpodcast@yahoo.com. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/CTG podcast. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/CTG podcast.
And you can follow my tweets as I'm watching the especially not very good films as I live tweet Robert my displeasure, like I did with Passion of the Christ and Planet of the Apes 2001.
Yes, and where can we find you?
At Michael M. Patty. MichaelMPatti.
Cool. So, till that time, this is Robert saying keep the faith.
And this is Mike saying peace out.